Welcome to the Bitcoin Infinity Academy, brought to you by Plan B Network and Bitbox. I'm Knut Svanholm, and I'm here, as always, with my partner in victimless crime, Luke DeWolf. How are you today, Luke?
I'm great, Knut. How are you?
All good. We're doing another chapter today.
Yes, we are. Next chapter of Sovereignty Through Mathematics, The Gullible Collective. I'm excited about this one. Definitely some interesting takes on collectivism. So
absolutely. If you don't know what this is, I mean, go to bitcoininfinity.com and you can get the book. You can go to our Geyser page and sign up for the academy and all of that. So, but let's just dive into it, shall we, Luke?
Let's do it. I'll start by reading the first paragraph. The Gullible Collective, Chapter 3 of Sovereignty Through Mathematics. We humans are biased by nature. Everything we think we know is distorted in one way or another by our cognitive shortcomings. The human brain has been forced to evolve and adapt to whatever environment it found itself in over millennia. Having a brain that is capable of setting aside personal aims for the sake of the collective has proven to be advantageous for the evolution of our species as a whole. The same is true for every other social form of life. However, letting these parts of our brains guide our political judgment can lead to disastrous results in the long run. Not because of bad intentions, but because of the simple fact that a few individuals will always thrive by playing every political system for personal gain. From an evolutionary perspective, an army of A-sayers and martyrs, regardless of whether we're talking about an army of humans or an army of ants or bacteria, has an advantage over a less disciplined one. From an individual's evolutionary perspective, though, it is better to appear like you're a martyr, but to run and hide when the actual battle happens. This at least partly explains the high percentage of sociopaths in leadership positions all over the world. If you can appear to act for the good of the collective, but dupe your way into more and more power behind people's backs, you're more likely to succeed than someone playing a fair game. Knut?
Yes. It's a bit of a strange paragraph to some, maybe, but I think this is alluding to incentives being the driving force for human beings and being super important. That's what the paragraph means. Why the sociopaths are where they are is because it's beneficial for them to be there. Political leaders, in particular, have a high percentage of sociopaths among them.
Yeah, I think the distinction between the individual and the collective is a theme that we explore a lot, that you explore in your writings, and that we have explored in the Inverse of Clown World and in many of our conversations. So I think this is one of those cases where people might have the wrong idea, I think, about collectivism in general. It's the thing that in the Western world, you're supposed to be a little collectivist somehow, right? We're all in this together. We live in a society. This is just the way things are. We live in these nice welfare states that provide for people. But there's a dark underside to that, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, there's nothing wrong with human beings grouping together and doing things together. The wrongness of it comes whenever there's violence or threats thereof involved. So we are primed to cooperate and help one another. It's just that some people think it's okay to do that at the expense of a third person or at the expense of another human being. And as we will learn through these books, that is never the case. The free market and consensual interactions are way more powerful than people think. And collectivism and market interventions are way worse than people think.
I definitely found it interesting here getting to the evolutionary side of this also, because it's also interesting to look at reasons that explain individuals' behavior, right? Like we talked about a little bit in the last episode, the financial atheism chapter. Well, maybe I'm drawing a different conclusion here, but there is an evolutionary explanation to us as a species, basically, if you believe the scientific consensus on that, such as it is. And evolutionary behaviors for what individuals do, I think it works perfectly well, because there are things hardwired in our brains that get us to lean towards doing certain things, and different brain configurations result in different individuals who behave differently. So I find it really interesting to dig into these reasons for why people do certain things. It certainly helps to build empathy, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is all evolutionary. This goes super deep, and it's straight out of, I don't believe you need to believe anything to buy this. We are, our bodies and our brains are just a collection of cells. Cells who all act in their own self best interest. So they have they do what they do because they're primed for survival. The cells that behaved in a certain way had a higher likelihood of surviving than cells that didn't. So that's at the core of our very being. And we're just a great hive of cellular organisms that found out over time that cooperating was better than fighting one another. That's what we are. What we do as a collective may be good for the human being, but not necessarily for the cells in the human being. So if we get a tattoo, for instance, to attract a woman, that might be good for the collection of cells, but not maybe for the individual cells in the arm that got the tattoo. Like, there's, you can take this to absurd levels. It's just to distinct between the what's good for the individual, what's good for the collective is not always necessarily good for the individual. That's what I'm trying to say with the paragraph, I think.
And maybe let's continue and explore this a bit further.
Sure.
On to the next one. The story of banking and fiat currency is a story about collective madness. Historically, rulers have tricked people into killing each other through the promise of an afterlife. Through central banking, the rulers of the world wars could trick people into building armies for them by printing more money. This is seldom mentioned in history classes because it still goes on today on a massive scale. Inflation might no longer be paying tank factory workers, but it is the main mechanism that funnels wealth into the pockets of the super rich and away from everyone else. Inflation is the mechanism that hinders us from transporting the value of our labor through time. It makes us avoid real long-term thinking. We hardly ever consider this a problem because none of us has ever experienced an alternative to it. Knut?
Yeah, this is the core of the problem that Bitcoin solves. Many people think inflation is a natural thing that just happens. But at the end of the day, it's always because someone is printing more money, giving it out as debt to people. This has been going on for centuries. Humans have never been able to resist enriching themselves at the expense of others by printing more money if they've had that power. And it still goes on today. And what I don't believe is like that there's a cabal of evil masterminds, like Dr. Evil types in a lair somewhere, like figuring out this way of mass control over people. It's just the incentives are there. Short-term incentives to make people do stuff. So even Nixon in 71, when he went off the gold standard, I think that was a very high time preference decision. Like, he didn't think of the consequences because the consequences weren't of consequence to him. He only had to think about the next couple of years and winning the next election and stuff. So high time preference and us having urges that we can't control is even behind the money being corrupt, which leads to even more high time preference decisions and even more stuff we can't control. So high time preference in this sense is the enemy here.
Totally agree. And I think it's great that you got into a couple of topics here in this paragraph. I think the point that you referenced in terms of the evil cabal, this is a set of ideas that gets explored quite a bit more in, for example, The Creature from Jekyll Island. I forget the author's name off the top of my head, but that's an easy one to find. I really enjoy that read because it's a very good history of inflation and money and all this. But it's definitely got some controversial elements, put it that way. And I think even through that one too, the Nixon example, it's funny to take any kind of devil's advocate on Nixon taking the US off the gold standard in 71. But the one argument I've heard that holds a little bit of water here on why not to blame Nixon specifically is more that the countries were already operating as if they weren't on a gold standard, basically. And if it hadn't have been Nixon, it would have been the next guy. Instead of Nixon in 71, it would have been Carter in 79 or whatever. I don't know. But it's just one of those things where that unless you absolutely are constrained away from being able to do the high time preference thing, it's going to happen eventually. Something like that. Someone is going to have too much temptation to do the thing. I don't know. Is that in line with what you were getting at here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's called Hanlon's Razor, and it's a bit like Gresham's Razor. It's never attribute to malice that can be explained by stupidity. It's one of my favorite razors. And this one in particular, it's totally true. Like the reason, one reason Nixon went off the gold standard is to keep funding the Vietnam War, which was costing a lot. Like running up to that, just as you say, there had been a lot of fractional reserve going on already. So they didn't have backing for all the gold receipts, aka dollar bills, that they had given out to people. So they were printing money before they let go of the gold standard. Letting go of the gold standard was a way of making that work short term. But it's like... It was a sacred principle that had to be sacrificed on this altar because of other high time preference decisions that came before. And it's just tragic. It's the tragedy of the commons, if you will. Like it's unfortunate that that happened. Then again, if that had not happened, we might not have had Bitcoin. So we would still be on a gold standard with semi-fake fiat receipts for gold. I kind of prefer a world where Bitcoin exists because it's way, way, way better and more hopeful than gold ever could dream of being. So yeah, we are where we are. History is what it is. And all we can do is like think of the future and move forward and learn by studying the past.
Yeah, and to tie this back, I think, to the central point, just to emphasize this a little bit, is the where you say it is about collective madness. Yeah. The thing here is we have social structures that empower individuals to make decisions for the collective. I think that's the central point here, is that the individuals are giving up their freedom, their sovereignty to other individuals who have their own motives. And having money in control of that is really the problem, as illustrated by the examples given, such as 1971.
Yeah, and people in power who got into those positions not because of merit, but because of theft and other like malicious mechanisms that put them in power. So this is the thing. Whenever you say that you want the government to do anything, or that you think that there should be a law forbidding this, you're also saying that you are okay with theft and you are okay with one human being deciding what's best for another. You are okaying people to put themselves on a pedestal. And I think people in general underestimate how dangerous that notion is. Like why people aren't libertarian. Like it's super dangerous to say that you believe that people should have that there should be positions of power that are not the result of merit. Yeah, I'm stumbling on the words here, but you get the point, I think. Look,
I do, and I think we'll continue on these points as we continue. So let's go on. Money is still vastly misunderstood by the lion's share of the world's population. In most parts of the world, banks do something called fractional reserve lending. This means that they lend out money that they don't have, conjuring up new money out of thin air and handing it out to their customers as loans. Loans that have to be paid back with interest. Interest that can't be paid back with thin air, but has to be paid with so-called real money. Real money of which there isn't enough around to pay back all the loans, so that a constant need for new credit becomes a crucial part of the entire system. Not to mention central banks, which do the same and worse for governments. We're so used to it by now that every country is expected to have a national debt. All but a handful of ridiculously rich ones do. National debts are also loans that have to be paid back with interest backed by nothing. Think about that. Your taxes are paying someone else's interest. Your tax money is not paying for your grandmother's bypass operation. It is paying interest to a central bank. Yeah, we started to get into some of the ideas from this paragraph here, but we're going deeper.
Yes, there was back when I first got interested in money and how money functions at all, there was a short YouTube series called Money as Debt. I can highly recommend it. And it explains fractional reserve banking and how it started. Like, so there was some guy in the city who had a vault, or the equivalent of a vault, where he could keep people's valuable goods. And he gave out receipts for mostly gold, because that's what people use to store in vaults. So here's a receipt for this and that much gold. And pretty soon that guy realized that he could print out more receipts than he had gold in his vaults, because the only time he would need all the gold is if everyone tried to withdraw their gold at the same time. Also known as a bank run. That's how the term bank run was born, because when people started to figure out that the guy was counterfeiting receipts, they responded by all withdrawing their gold at the same time, which is when the bank went bankrupt and the banker was exposed as the fraud he was. Until the invention of the central bank, which was like invented to prevent bank runs by bailing out the bank that was supposed to go bankrupt. They avoided a short-term problem by postponing it and snowballing it into way bigger problem way later down the line. And that's what we're living in now. We're living in this perpetual debt cycle that just grows and grows and grows, as you have to pay interest upon interest upon interest. All the fiat currencies turn into hockey stick curve, hyperinflating things sooner or later. Inflation is just hyperinflation in slow motion. So yeah, this is what this paragraph is about, and what my books are about.
Definitely. And I think the core concept here that everyone getting into Bitcoin has to grok at some point is the mechanism that inflation has, why fractional reserve banking just doesn't work and requires that inflation. I think it's really well explained in this paragraph here. Money gets loaned out at an interest rate and must be paid back. It's a game of musical chairs, something like that, unless more...
Exactly.
Yeah, unless more credit is getting added into the system, which is now the current system we're in. And central banks, to backstop banks from fractional reserve, there are good explanations of why fractional reserve banking, particularly I think Lynn Alden makes this argument that fractional reserve banking is not all bad. It's just the amount of it. And it doesn't necessarily even need to hit the money supply, something like this. I don't know enough about this specific thing to agree or not. I say maybe keep it simple and just don't have that. But having a lender of last resort is the thing that is a lender of last resort that is required under a threat of violence definitely makes the system worse. That's my take on it anyway.
It's also important to stress that fractional reserve is possible on Bitcoin, but much harder to pull off, since everyone can audit everything at any point in time. So for instance, a custodial wallet, like Wallet of Satoshi, for instance, could theoretically do fractional reserve banking already, as long as not everyone was taking out all the Bitcoin at the same time. They could pretend to have more Bitcoin than they actually have because they only need that much in circulation at any point in time. But they have checks on it. Like, they can't do too much of it. With fiat, you can literally do it forever until people lose faith in the currency and you go into civil unrest. So, and which is what all fiat currencies are on that trajectory. They've all died the same way. They get printed into oblivion and lose all their value. And it's tragic that it goes on. And hopefully now Bitcoin is the remedy to all of that.
Yeah, hopefully. Completely agree. And you know, isn't it really the case that I've tried to think through this problem multiple times, that you can't really give someone a loan in Bitcoin terms and get interest back in Bitcoin terms without someone losing somewhere? Or maybe to extend that slightly, because I think we also talk about how it's not a zero-sum game, but whoever is doing whoever is taking the loan needs to get more value back than the amount of the interest rate, basically, for it to make sense in Bitcoin terms. When we're denominating in fiat, it's an entirely different matter. But when it's in Bitcoin terms, in order for any kind of lending and interest rate to work, someone has to be doing something with that investment, right?
Yeah, and it's pretty hard to get above that threshold. But the opposite is also true. Like, in fiat, someone always loses. Like, you cannot have inflation without there being a loser somewhere. Like, it's impossible. And this is true for every, as soon as there's market interventionisms or market interventions, someone loses. Like, someone is making a trade they wouldn't have made if that intervention wasn't there. So it's always at the expense of someone. All inflation is theft. All taxes are theft. All interventions are theft. There's no way around this. There's always a loser when any of these things are prevalent in society. The only way for the market to be the win-win mechanism that it is for there to be no interventionism. Like, if I exchange something with you on a black market, so-called black market, voluntarily, with consent, and no third parties involved, then we both win, or at least we perceive we both win. Whenever there's any intervention, including inflation, someone loses. The guy that got that dollar bill at some point is being, there's a breach of contract whenever a single new dollar bill is put into existence, because it dilutes the value of that dollar that the first guy had. Like, there's no way around this. And this might be where I disagree with Lynn. I don't know her exact position, so I'm not going to pick this battle here, but I'm very Rothbardian in my thinking around this. That it cannot be done without a winner and a loser scenario. Like, it's fiduciary media. Fractional reserve, the only time I could think it's okay, it's if everyone involved was aware of the fractional reserve banking going on, which would defeat the very purpose of fractional reserve banking. So that cannot happen. It is fraud. Like, that's what it is. Like, why would anyone agree to having less back than they put into the bank? That's a very bad investment. If you put something away in an account or invest in something, you want a return on your investment. You don't want less purchasing power when you get the thing back. Money is not a producer good nor a consumer good. It's a good sui generis, meaning that its only reason for existence is being a medium of exchange. And if that loses value, in other words, if it's a bad medium of exchange over time, then some theft is going on somewhere. There's no way around this. So Bitcoin is the first and only, probably the last, instance where money functions in a way where this is not possible, which makes it completely different from everything else. Much bigger deal than people think it is.
Another funny idea along these lines that I've heard is that custodians, because to a certain extent, banks are fancy custodians that just do a ton of extra stuff basically, with the money deposited, they'll turn into paid custodians. In other words, you pay someone to hold your Bitcoin for you, basically, which is an interesting thought, but it might work for some people. In other words, you don't trust yourself to hold your own keys 100%. So you pay someone else to take the risk for you, essentially. And in the absence of other ways of making money off of that service, basically, the custodian is just going to charge a fee. And we actually see that these days already with multi-sig solutions. Like there's a charge to use one of the other keys that is being held by someone else, for example. So maybe it's not necessarily the case of someone holds your Bitcoin, as in the UTXOs with all keys, but these multi-sig solutions, it's sort of a model like that. I think it's an interesting one, basically.
No, there's nothing wrong with custodians in general. Like, if you want to have someone custodies your stuff, then that's fine. The problem is when it's when there's fraud involved. And the concept of a bank just using the money you put in your account to invest in other stuff and lend out that money, not to invest, but to lend out that money to other people to make a return on the investment and, you know, one interest rate paying for the other. It's not inherently wrong as long as it's completely transparent and both parties are aware of all the risks with the contract, because there's no risk-free lending. Like, that doesn't work. You don't automatically get interest without there being a risk involved. You should be aware that whenever you have an interest on something paid by someone, it's because someone else is taking a risk with your money. Otherwise, there's fraud. Like, I don't think I can explain it better than that.
The only thing I'll add to this is basically we've spent longer than I anticipated we would on this section, but it's so important, and also it's just, this is working so great. I'm really enjoying digging into the specifics of these things so much. But there are other interesting things in this chapter. This wasn't even the point of this chapter, basically. So shall we continue?
Yes, this is a show of tangents.
Show of tangents, yes. Well, let's put that aside for later.
Yeah, you were thinking proof of work, proof of results, show of tangents, right?
Something like that, yes. Very good.
Let's get on with it.
Good stuff. All right, on to the next one. When the ideas of the Catholic Church ruled Europe, people who didn't believe in God were few and very seldomly outspoken. They had good reason for this, since belief in God was virtually mandatory throughout society. Ever since 1971, when famously dishonest American President Richard Nixon cut the last string that tied the US dollar to gold, our conception of what the world economy is and ought to be has been skewed by an utterly corrupt system. We are led to believe that we're all supposed to work longer and longer days in order to spend more and more money and bury ourselves in more and more debt to keep the machine running. We're duped into thinking that buying a new car every other year is somehow good for the environment, and that bringing a cotton bag to the grocery store will somehow save the planet. Stores manipulate us all the time through advertising and product placement, but we're led to believe that if we can be climate smart, we're behaving responsibly. Somehow, our gross domestic product is supposed to increase indefinitely, while politicians will save us from ourselves through carbon taxes. Fortunately for us, and unfortunately for them, there now exists a way for unbelievers of this narrative to opt out. Life finds a way, as Jeff Goldblum once so famously put it. Knut?
I would say that this paragraph is the TLDR of the inverse of clown world, wouldn't you? Very much so. It's about how, the effects we talked about after the last paragraph with, you know, ever increasing, exponentially worse problems through ever increasing interest rates leads to more and more clownish political decisions and narratives. And we end up in this society where we don't take any responsibility. We just want to virtue signal that we do. And we end up with clown world. That's it.
Totally agree. And I think what's funny here is we basically said most of what is in this paragraph earlier in our discussion here. Not every single detail, but the thrust of it. And, you know, just the funny little details in the middle here. Things like gross domestic product. I really, really like having figured out that gross domestic product is just the thing that has to keep going up, that a fixed denominator would turn into deflation.
Gross is such a good word to describe it. It is gross.
Yes, yes.
Vulgar even, and not a number to be taken seriously. It does not measure progress. That you can't measure progress because value is subjective. Like this, it's all made up to rationalize statism. All of these figures are like the official inflation numbers, the basket of goods. It's all bullshit. Don't fall for it.
No, don't fall for it. As you say, we somewhat dig into a lot of this stuff in much more detail in future chapters. So I think for now, maybe let's get to the main point of this one. On to the next one. Collectivism has ruined many societies. Those of us fortunate enough to live in liberal democracies tend to forget that even democracy is an involuntary system. It's often referred to as the worst form of government except all others that have been tried. But the system itself is very rarely criticized. We're so used to being governed that not having a leader seems preposterous to most of us. Still, we pay our taxes, and an enormous cut of the fruit of our labor goes to a third party via inflation and the taxation of every good and service imaginable. Institutions, once in place, tend to always favor their own survival just as much as any other living thing does. People employed in the public sector are unlikely to vote against policies that threaten their livelihood. This is a bigger problem than we realize because it's subtle and takes a long time. But every democracy is headed in the same direction. A bigger state, a more complicated system, and fewer individual freedoms. Long term, it seems that all of our systems tend to favor those who know how to play that system, and not those who contribute the most value to their fellow man. Proponents of socialist policies often claim that failed socialist states weren't really socialists. Proponents of socialist policies often claim that failed socialist states weren't really socialist, or that that wasn't really socialism. What most people fail to realize is that we've never tried real capitalism, since we've always used more or less inflationary currencies. This might very well be the most skewed narrative of our era. We're all experiencing real, albeit disguised, socialism every single day. True free market capitalism is what we haven't experienced yet, and it might turn out to be a very different thing than what we're told to believe that it is by almost all mainstream media. Yes.
Yeah, a crucial point, and I think a thing that so many people miss. I hear people blaming the free market for this and that all the time. Which is to me it's oxymoronic even to blame the free market for anything, because how would you come to a consensus on what constitutes a problem if not on the free market of ideas? Like everything, all the free market is people doing things of their own volition, like with consent, like. They want to do the thing. Everyone wants the free market. There is no one that doesn't want a free market. If I've never heard anyone say, "Oh, how I wish that some third party came in here and made my life harder and stopped me from doing what I'm trying to do right now," which is what you want if you don't want the free market to decide things. And this is so misunderstood. Like the free market isn't a thing. It's a process. It's the process of people doing things because they want to, not because they're forced to.
A funny thing here also is that these things are so subtle, it's easy to ignore them, right? You make the point here that all of this stuff is just slow. That's why it creeps up on us. It's the frog getting boiled in the pot,
Yeah, slippery slope. Every political decision is a slippery slope.
And I think it's just because none of this stuff is that visible, that we don't worry about it, basically. But it does keep getting worse and worse and make life harder and harder. I saw a tweet that no one wants to work anymore has been said in newspapers since the 1900s. And yeah. I just think that's really funny, because it's a comment on attitudes, that which has been the norm for a long time is no longer fashionable. Like, I think if people have a choice not to be coal miners, they might choose not to be coal miners. But the thing there too is that it's a combination of advancing technological progress, as in individuals aren't necessarily wanting to do backbreaking labor if they can have a robot do it for them instead, program a robot to do the thing, for example. Or it's that you get less and less for your labor all the time because of inflation and because of so much getting siphoned away to this and that place. And I just think that it's so hard to convince people that this is a problem. And really, it takes getting what the problem is with inflation, what the problem is with collectivism, to eventually get to what the solutions are. And it's not that it's a bad thing on a micro level that some people are isolated from this. It's good that humanity is progressing in such a way that this isn't something on everyone's minds. But it is the case that many people are affected by inflation to such an extent that they should be thinking about it. But it's so hidden that they don't know that's the problem. People direct their energy towards, let's fix the climate, or let's blame these millionaires. Something within the system is supposed to solve the problem for them, when it's the system that is the problem. That's the tragedy, and that's what I hope we can start to solve a little bit more.
Yeah, no, fiat ruins everything, as Jimmy Song said. Like, all prices ought to go down forever, and everything ought to be cheaper forever. It's the simple questions like we ask in Clown World, like, if you practice doing something, do you usually get better or worse at doing that thing? Well, you usually get better, so why aren't all prices going down forever? And if you use Bitcoin, they are. If you see the world through a Bitcoin lens, all prices are going down forever, which is, by the way, what saves people. Like, from all the fears about the jobs, they took our jobs from AI and stuff, and all industrial revolutions have had these fears. And technological progress does not make people more poor. They make people more wealthy. The problem is, like, a minimum wage law, for instance, you can deductively reason an a priori axiomatic thinking yourself into the position that minimum wage laws always lead to a worse outcome than if they weren't there. On a completely free market, there cannot be unemployment, because there's always someone willing to pay something to have something done. And in a world where oil prices go down, this is not a problem for everyone. Like, the money, it's the money, stupid. Like, if the money was working, we wouldn't need any of the other stuff. And the whole notion that we need someone to fix a problem is the problem.
Couldn't agree more. And it's funny, I think where we're going next hits on some other political things here. So I think
it's a very political chapter, isn't it?
It is. On to the next one. The validity of the classic right-left scale describing political viewpoints has been debated a lot lately, and alternative scales like Gaultan, the one with an additional y-axis describing more or less authoritarian tendencies, are popping up in various contexts around the web. After the birth of Bitcoin, there's a new way to see this. Imagine an origo, a zero point, and a vector pointing to the left of that. all politics are arguably on the left because all policies need to be funded by taxes, and taxation can be viewed as theft. Taxation can be viewed as theft because, at its core, it's involuntary. If a person refuses to pay his taxes, there is a threat of violence lurking in the background. Not to mention inflation, which Milton Friedman so elegantly described as taxation without legislation. What you do with the portion of your wealth that you have in Bitcoin is another matter altogether. If you take sufficient precautionary privacy measures and you know what you're doing, your business in Bitcoin is beyond politics altogether. With the introduction of the Lightning Network and other privacy-improving features, it is now impossible for any third party to confiscate your money or even know that you have it, for that matter. This changes the political landscape of every nation on Earth. Bitcoin is much less confiscatable than gold and other scarce assets, which makes it a much better tool for hedging against nation-states. In this sense, Bitcoin obsoletes borders. You can cross any border on Earth with any amount of Bitcoin in your head. Think about that. Your Bitcoin exists in every country simultaneously. Any imposed limit on how much money you can carry from one nation to the other is now made obsolete by beautiful mathematics. Bitcoin is sometimes referred to as a virtual currency. This is a very inaccurate description. Bitcoin is just mathematics, and mathematics is just about the most real thing there is. There's nothing virtual about it. Counterintuitive to some, but real nonetheless. Knut?
Yeah, to me, this is like, these things are at the core of what Bitcoin is to me, like a complete reimagination of what money is and what money ought to be. Bitcoin has sort of pointed out to everyone in the world that money doesn't need to be anything but information. The Satoshis exist in every country at once, but the ability to move them exists within the owner's head. Because you don't really own your Bitcoin, you just find the probability that someone else knows the same key to be so low so that you practically own them in a sense, because you're the one that knows the key. No, and it's going to change everything. It changes how we interact. It changes the validity of the nation state as a concept, I think, because like the borders cannot stop this. Like guns cannot stop this. I think this is all for good. I think this is all better. And there are a couple of things here about Bitcoin and privacy. It's everything in this paragraph is only true if about non-KYC Bitcoin. So if you buy them not on an exchange, but if you accept them for your goods and services and such. One of the technicalities everyone should know about on-chain Bitcoin that aren't, you know, coin-joined or anything, is that the person you buy them from knows when you spend them. He knows when that Bitcoin moves to another address. You can look that up. Not everyone is aware of that. The Lightning Network makes privacy better. Other things do too. And the more time that passes, the more the Bitcoins and their owners get mixed up. And this is a good thing. It makes it harder for people who want to confiscate them to figure out what's really going on.
Yeah, it's the paragraph somewhat starts with another point about politics, basically. The taxation without legislation point, I think, is a good sum up to that. There's a couple of interesting things here. One, first of all, the Galtan scale, I think the political compass would be more well known here, at least in the English speaking world. I actually didn't know what the Galtan scale was. And when I looked it up, it has articles on both Finnish and Swedish Wikipedia. So I was able to read it, but it looks like it's only used in those countries.
So it's a bit of a Swenglish version of
Yeah, I think it's slightly different, but it pretty much is this political compass idea where it adds...
More or less authoritarian. Yeah, you've all seen it, I guess, anyway. Yeah.
But I think your portrayal that it is from an origin point and all politics is left and upward, basically, something like that. It's an interesting one because it certainly does capture the essence that all of the things that governments do, that politics do, has to be funded by something, and that funding has to come from somewhere. I think this opens up interesting thought experiments that I don't want to dive into too deeply right now. But for example, we have had conversations about free cities, right? Like, I think that's a concept that tries to get this done a little bit differently. Like, what if instead of taxes, you're paying a fee? And then what's the difference between the two, right? If you live in a free city and you stop paying the fee, are they allowed to kick you out? Do you really own what you have there, your property, something like that? It's interesting stuff. It's just more like, I think the point to get across is all things need to be paid for somehow. And by obfuscating where that comes from is where many of the problems lie.
Yeah, is it voluntary or not? It's a very simple question. Like the fee for the private city, you pay that voluntarily when you enter the city and when you buy a property in it. Like the taxes, not so much. You pay them because there's a gun to your head. And if you can avoid them, they do. I don't know any person who wants to pay, that he should pay or she should pay more taxes. Everyone wants fewer taxes or less taxes for themselves, but that others should pay more for some odd reason.
Well, there is also, I think there's a funny group that says something like, oh, I don't mind paying so much taxes. I wouldn't even mind if I paid more taxes. This is a very privileged group, I think.
Yeah.
Because they think that the answer to society's problems is, yeah, let the government take more money and figure it out. But instead, you could use that money to do something productive yourself. If you care about one of the many causes that is plaguing the world, homelessness is one of the ones that gets brought up a lot in the US because it's a big problem there. Well, you as a private individual could donate time or money to helping some homeless people or help to alleviate some of the structural problems of homeless people. But, well, many government initiatives to solve that problem don't seem to be all that effective. So I think it's a bit of a fallacy, but it's a common one. And of course, there are plenty of people that say that taxes are the price you pay to live in a decent society. I'm paraphrasing, but it's unfortunate because the only option that you have to not do that is to leave. And then there are people that say that there should be exit taxes. That when you choose to leave a jurisdiction, you have to pay them to not get, I don't know, again, thrown in jail or violence again, something like that. It's all clown world. It's all that.
I mean, the comment, I wouldn't mind to pay higher taxes. Yeah, there's a very Scandinavian thing to say to begin with. But I think everyone who says that is a liar because nothing is stopping them from paying more taxes. Watch what they do, not what they say. Like, you can donate money to the government. Not like, no one is going to stop you, especially not the government. So I simply don't buy that. Like, it's always a lie. It's virtue signaling, and it's very disingenuous.
Yes,
there was actually has been examples of voluntary tax funds. Like there was such a thing in Norway, and after a year or so, they got the fantastic amount of 1,700 euros from the entire country or something like that. That's what people were willing to give up. But so it doesn't work because no one wants to pay for something where they cannot know what they're getting back. Like if you pay for a car, you pay for the car. Like if you pay taxes, you have no way of knowing how much worth you got for your, how much value back you got for your money. Like there's simply no way. So everyone prefers transactions where they know what they get. And everyone who says otherwise is a liar.
Yeah. And another thing here too, is that Norway of all places, I mean, Norway has massive taxes already, even though it's got this massive sovereign wealth fund from its natural resources, and then asking people to pay more anyway. It's just laughable. And I think it's also the case that the another side to this fallacy really is that there's a complaint. Why don't people donate to charity more? well, you're already giving so much of your money to the government if you have the resources to donate to charity in the first place. And charities are another whole thing altogether, honestly. Most charities spend most of their money on internal administrative costs. And I think they're just as bad as the government at actually doing things. So there's something here. Solving the world's problems collectively, or channeling the energy of many individuals into a shared group goal, is a perfectly valid and worthy thing if it's all done voluntary and people have a stake in it and they want to see the thing succeed and there are incentives for the thing to succeed. But when it's done through this mechanism of, oh, I'm just going to throw money at it and let someone else worry about the problem, I think it comes back to the original point that sociopaths co-opt these mechanisms and ruin it. Without the sociopaths, maybe we don't really have so much of a problem here. But the sociopaths ruin everything.
Then again, I think it would be ruined anyway because so this is a thing that Mises pointed out in his book about socialism, that it's not an incentive problem, but a price signaling problem. Because if the state takes control of the means of production, which it does to some extent by just taxing and inflating the normal things a state does, it does skew the market signal. Any intervention skews the market signal, and it makes it harder for producers to produce what consumers want. So you end up with the Soviet Union, where there's like kilometers of line you have to wait in to get a loaf of bread, because no one produces what needs to be produced. So the sociopaths is one part of the problem, but the bigger problem is the price signals, because money doesn't measure value; it signals value, and this is what the main misconception of what money is, I think.
Love it. And the price signal is definitely another one of those concepts we'll dig more into at other times. So,
absolutely.
On to the next one. The complexity of human social hierarchies and power structures is described perfectly in a classic children's book, The Emperor's New Clothes, by Hans Christian Andersen. See the world as the kid who points out that the king is naked in the tale, and everything starts to make sense. Everything in human society is man-made. Nations, leaders, laws, political systems. They're all castles in the air with nothing but a lurking threat of violence to back them up. Bitcoin is a different beast altogether. It enables every individual to verify the validity of the system at all times. If you really think about it, morality is easy. Don't hurt other people and don't steal other people's stuff. That's the basic premise. Humans have but two ways of resolving conflict: conversation and violence. And in this sense, to hurt someone can only mean physical violence. This is why free speech is so important and why you should defend people's right to speak their minds above everything else. It's not about being able to express yourself. It's about your right to hear every side of every argument, and thus not have to resort to violence should a conflict of interests occur. You can't limit free speech with just more speech. There's always a threat of violence behind the limitations. Code, which both Bitcoin and the internet are entirely made up of, is speech. Any limitations or regulations that your government implements in regard to Bitcoin are not only a display of Bitcoin's censorship resistance, but also a test of your government's stance on freedom of expression. A restriction on Bitcoin use is a restriction on free speech. Knut?
Yes, this is an interesting paragraph. I've somewhat changed my views here, I'd say, and say that free speech laws are a downstream of property rights. So if we had absolute property rights, there wouldn't be a need for freedom of speech laws. Because freedom of speech is only applicable to public domains, like a public square or a public social media outlet, whatever it might be, public service television. And those are all preceded by an expropriation of someone's property. The government had to steal stuff because before they could make public property a thing. So, in this way, I think freedom of speech and property rights are inexorably linked, and that you can't have one without the other. If you have absolute property rights, and I get to say, I get to dictate who gets to say what on my social media platform. I get to dictate who gets to say what on my property in my house. And I also get the right to throw people out who say things that I don't want to listen to. So, and this is great. And on Noster, for instance, you get to decide what to do with your posts. No one else owns them. If you use X, Elon gets to decide. And Elon is more expensive to bribe than many others, which is a good thing. Anyway, the whole thing is money is just speech and information. And Bitcoin has pointed that out to us, that there is no difference between a physical object and information in the sense that, in the value sense, value is entirely subjective. Like this, it's all Austrian economics. That's at the base of it. And once again, I'd like to stress that if you're pro anything that isn't free market, that isn't sound money capitalism, that isn't anarcho-consensualism, then you implicitly are pro-violence. You think that it's okay for people to use violence and threats thereof to impose their will on others. And I do not. I don't think violence is okay. That's at the core of why I have the values I do.
Very good explanation. And, you know, I think my best response is actually, I'm realizing that I should have just continued reading the very last paragraph here, because it might as well have been exactly what you just said. So I think I'm just going to read that and we'll see if there's anything else to say about it. Remember, the only alternative to speech that anyone has is violence. Code is a language, mathematics is a language, and money is a linguistic tool. A linguistic tool we use as a means of expressing value to each other and as a way to transport value through space and time. Any restrictions or regulations regarding how you can express value, for example, making it impossible to buy Bitcoin with your credit card, prove that the money you have in your bank account is not really yours. When people realize this, the demand for Bitcoin goes up, not down. If you know what you're doing, there's no need to fear the regulators. They, on the other hand, have good reason to fear an invention that shamelessly breaks their spell.
Yeah. I mean, this is a point that I think few people get. Politicians trying to ban Bitcoin and trying to stop people from using Bitcoin actually help Bitcoin succeed. I think that's an underrated point, like underappreciated point. What they do is, A, they show to people that they think Bitcoin is valuable. Otherwise, they wouldn't need to do anything about it. And they limit the supply even more in that specific jurisdiction, making the Bitcoins that are left even more scarce for other people. And thus, demand stays the same, number goes up. Like, it's very simple. It's like politicians trying to decide that the ocean shouldn't be there the day after, but the ocean is still there. Like, they can't do anything about it. It's a force of nature.
I think this is just a fantastic summary and wrapping up exactly what you've been saying here about speech and information and the freedom to do that and to do so. I think I'll echo just one thing that we keep saying whenever we talk about freedom. A lot of times when we talk about freedom, is that the flip side of the coin to freedom is responsibility. When you have the freedom to do the things you want to do, you also take the responsibility for your own actions. And there could be consequences for those actions. So sending money to someone in a way that is permissionless, you might never get that back. And that can be scary. But at the same time, it is free. And so we have to take all the trade-offs as they are, basically. in order to get away from any kind of collectivism, the only answer we could ever have is the individual. And the individual needs to take responsibility for itself, sovereignty, all of the things. And this is something that Bitcoin promotes so well. But I think maybe it's a case of that it's part of the problem with Bitcoin's marketing, something like that. Why fewer people get Bitcoin is that maybe they're running away from that responsibility. It's hard being in control. Some people want to not have control, I guess.
Yeah, they want a shepherd to tell them what to do. I'd say as a final point here, my final point to this is that don't steal is the core of both freedom and responsibility. Don't steal needs to be there for both sides of that coin to be there. So you need people around you to not steal in order for you to be free, and you need to not steal in order to take responsibility. Stealing is not taking responsibility. Taking responsibility is doing things, is trading with other people and trading with a future self and making voluntary transactions. If you're stealing, it doesn't fucking count. You're not taking responsibility. And other people around you can't be free if you're stealing from them. So don't steal. If I were to do a TLDR on this specific chapter, it would be don't steal. I think it's actually a TLDR on all four books. Don't steal.
Perfect summary. I say we wrap it up there.
I say we do. Thank you for this one, Luke.
Yes, thank you, Knut. And the next one is called An Immaculate Conception. So that will be interesting.
Very much so.
Okay. Well, with that, I think we should just remind everyone how to get involved. So the easiest way to do so, of course, is via our Geyser campaign. This is how you can join the Bitcoin Infinity Academy, get involved with the discussions. We have our Telegram group where we discuss everything that is going on in Bitcoin Infinity universe, including the Academy, including our show, including everything else that we have coming up. And you can join the specific courses, so you can join us live for these discussions as they happen. But of course, everything is still available for free on Noster, and the video discussions are available on YouTube. So let us know what you think. Leave us a comment if you're watching on YouTube or Rumble, and share with anyone you like. Give a comment on Twitter, whatever. We appreciate everything and want to discuss things further. So come join us.
In other words, like, subscribe, and brush your teeth.
That's basically the short of it. And I think we also should mention our sponsors here. So thank you to Plan B for enabling this fantastic initiative, where we are working with them. They're fantastic resource. They're a fantastic educational resource. So go to planb.network and check out everything you have going. It's a great complement to what we're doing with the Academy, and is very much, we're very glad to be in line with what we're doing with Plan B Network.
Yes. And don't forget to check out the Bitbox. Go to bitbox.swiss to find our favorite hardware wallet. We have a discount code there, Infinity, as everywhere else. So check that out. It's very user-friendly and an overall great hardware wallet.
Absolutely. And finally, just a reminder of everywhere you can see us conference-wise. First, Knut is in Ireland in May, but then we're aligned for basically the rest of the summer here. So we're going to be in Prague. Then we're going to be in Calgary for Bitcoin Rodeo. Then we're going to be in Riga. And then we're going to be in Helsinki for BTC Hell. And so join all of those conferences if they're convenient for you, and you can come see us, get a book signed, whatever you like, hang out, talk about all this stuff. But come to Helsinki if you can at all, if at all possible. We're really excited about this. The The vibes are awesome. The team is really excited about it, not just us. So come see us there. You can do the Riga Helsinki trip all in one go if you want to, if you've been holding off on this, if you live somewhere really far away. So come see us in any conference you like, but really try to come to Helsinki if you can.
Yeah, go to hell. There's a reason why there's a highway to hell and only a stairway to heaven.
Perfect. I think with that, we can put a ribbon on this one.
See you in the next one.
This has been the Bitcoin Infinity Academy. Thank you for listening.